You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Nate Silver accurately predicted how 49 out of the 50 states would vote in the 2008 election, plus the winner in each of the 35 Senate races that year, Politico sat up and took notice. Mr. Silver had already been applying his statistical analysis to baseball for years. In a new book, he explains why not all predictions are created equal. The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't, is published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Nate Silver to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
It's estimated that 2.5 quintillion bytes of information are now being created on a daily basis. How in the world is it possible to sift through all of that data?
Well, it's not, and that's the problem. And I should say a lot of that information is cat videos posted on YouTube or your 15-year-old daughter text messaging about Justin Bieber or something. But there's so much data today and so much information that we have to pick and choose, whether we like it or not, which data we look at.
Is that massive amount of information the noise in your title?
Sure. I mean, if the amount of information is increasing much faster than the amount of useful information, right? And that means more of that information is just noise. It is irrelevant and can distract you from trying to extract the signal, as we call it, or to find the truth, more simply put.
Can we blame it all on the internet?
Partly. I mean, both that gives us different ways or ways to pick and choose how we consume information more, and also cable television now, where there aren't just three or four network broadcasts that you watch. You can have a highly specialized channel, and you have a lot of choices as a news consumer, and that means you can actually filter out the news you don't like, and kind of puts you in a bubble where maybe you're not getting the most holistic perspective on how things are evolving.
Did something similar on a smaller scale happen after Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press in the 15th century?
Yes, if you've read the introduction to the book, I point out that
I asked the question.
Yeah. This is not the first time we've had kind of an explosion of information, where when the printing press was invented in the 1400s, you saw the number of books in circulation increase manyfold by hundreds of times in just 20 or 30 years, which back then was just the blink of an eye, so to speak. And what happened then is, instead of having people start to agree more because they could share their ideas, you had a lot more sectarianism, where you had the Protestant Reformation, very much tied to the printing press, where Luther's theses were reproduced hundreds of thousands of times. And now people had evidence for, hey, my ideas are different than yours and they're better than yours. And people had a lot of wars before finally we started to make more scientific and technological progress. So it's always a mixed blessing, where you're bombarded with an array of information and you don't really have good techniques for how to handle it. And people sometimes retreat into letting it confirm their biases.
So we tend to find patterns that turn out to be meaningless instead of actually find the real signal?
Sure. So we have brains that are still very kind of rooted in caveman times, the kind of architecture of our brains, where we're designed to react quickly to threats, right? And so you have to make an inference if you're trying to keep your family safe and you're a caveman. Is that rustling in the wind over there, does that indicate a lion encroaching on my camp, or is it just the random noise, right? And so we have a fight or flight instinct, especially with our visual cortexes and orally, and we react very quickly. That type of thinking is not necessarily, though, appropriate or helpful when we're bombarded with this much information that's kind of not what we grew up with, and we can perceive signals hyperactively even when there are none there.
But I would assume that we have gotten better at predicting things overall in recent years, because now we have computer programs to help us.
We have gotten better at predicting some things. To take one example is, right now we think of predicting the tides, for example, or the position of the planets as being impeccably precise, and it is. But 200 years ago, those were enormous problems, where there were some forecasts that had Jupiter and Saturn crashing into one another. Of course, that fortunately didn't turn out to be true. But the challenge is that although we have more information now, it also changes the way that people relate to one another, where the economy now is more complex than it used to be. Something like the spread of the flu is more complex than it used to be, because people travel more. You can have a flu spread to 25 countries all around the world within the span of a few days, whereas there was a longer lag period before. So although our methods might be becoming more robust, human interactions are also becoming more complicated, and so we're kind of running against a moving target.
Well, beyond predictions. There are, when they take polls, they find that many people in this country, where so much is available to us, believe in all sorts of unproven things. That is because their biases take over?
Sure. I mean, ever since kind of the dawn of the computer age, right, and which coincided with the dawn of really cable television, you've seen an increase in partisanship as measured by the votes in the Congress or how many people identify themselves as being strong partisans. So again, this kind of romantic idea that we have that we get more information, we refine our views, and it brings us toward the truth is not what we've really been seeing. And there's even evidence that people who have more information sometimes become more partisans. So, for example, the more informed people are about global warming, studies have found, the more they get into their own camps and can disagree with one another and have more facts at their disposal to supposedly testify to their case.
My guest is Nate Silver, a statistician, writer, and founder of the New York Times political blog 538.com. He has also developed PECOTA, a system for forecasting baseball performance that was bought by Baseball Prospectus, and we'll get into PECOTA later. His book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. So what makes a good prediction?
So some of the qualities are not what you would expect intuitively. We think people who are comfortable with uncertainty and probability, who are not going to go up there and say, I'm prognosticating exactly what the future is going to look like, but who think of it more as a gambler might in terms of odds and probabilities. One example of good predictions we give in the book is weather forecasting. 20 years ago,
it doesn't feel like the weather forecasters are correct.
That's the thing, and there are some exceptions, which we'll get to in a moment. But you know, some people think, oh, they say there's a 20% chance of rain. They don't really know anything, right? But it turns out that that's one of the fields we can say there's been a lot of progress. 25 years ago, if you had a hurricane sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, they didn't know whether it would hit literally Florida or Texas. The whole Gulf Coast was in play. Now they can nail that down to about 100 miles on average, which means you can evacuate a few counties in Louisiana or Alabama or Mississippi. People might not listen to the evacuation order. That was a bit of a problem during Katrina. But that very tangibly saves lives, and they've reduced the forecast error by more than twice.
So what makes it easier to forecast that than some other things that would seem to me to be just as easily forecastable?
So part of what helps with weather forecasting is that we actually have a pretty good idea of how the physics and the chemistry of the weather system work. So we're not just kind of looking at data and trying to reverse engineer the process. The contrast would be to something like earthquakes, where we haven't made much progress at prediction. And I talked to an earthquake forecaster in the book who summarizes the problem as, well, weather forecasters get to look up, but we're looking down and we're looking at rock. We can't really see what's causing these. We only experience the data, but it doesn't really tell us about the structure. And it's much harder to make predictions when you don't know the why about why something's occurring.
There was a report just this morning about the effect of climate change on the North and the South Poles. And it turns out that the South Pole, the water is actually getting colder while it's getting warmer in the North Pole. And none of the computer models predicted this.
Yeah, so global warming certainly is a very complex thing to try and model. I think one thing people might not realize is that if you look at what's really in the IPCC reports, which are the gold standard reports, they're very clear about saying, look, the basics here are that the greenhouse effect exists, and we put more CO2 up in the atmosphere, and the greenhouse effect will warm the planet, other things being equal. They don't go into that much detail deliberately because the predictions shouldn't be more precise than that when these models are looking far into the future. But so people, I think, on the one hand, don't listen enough to the basic core message of what they're saying. On the other hand, maybe pay too much attention to the detailed predictions when they don't always come out to fruition.
Do we use the same kinds of tools whether we're predicting baseball or a presidential election?
I think there's a fluency in prediction where if you learn Spanish, that doesn't mean you know Portuguese, but probably makes it easier to learn Portuguese. But it's important to be sensitive to how rich the data is. So in baseball, literally everything that's happened on a Major League Baseball playing field for the past 150 years has been recorded. You have hundreds of thousands of player seasons, as we call them, which means Derek Jeter's 2012, for instance. So you can really just kind of run your numbers in a model and pull that out and take it off the shelf and do pretty well. In politics and presidential elections, we've only had, I think, 16 presidential elections since World War II, really fewer than that since we've had as much polling as we do now. And so, you know, it's much harder to make inferences based on, you know, 15 cases when there are so many variables that could affect how people vote.
At the opening of a sports season, the newspapers, the magazines all predict who's going to do well and who isn't. They're usually forgotten by the time the actual event occurs.
Sure.
With the exception of Harold Camping or the Mayan calendar, we forget them.
Yeah. And that's also true in political predictions. So the weekend before the 2008 election, I watched the McLaughlin Group, which I talk about in the book. And so McLaughlin, this was at a point in time when Obama was up by 7 or 8 points in the polls, ahead in every swing state. Not really it's a softball question to say who's going to win, right? But two of the four panelists said it was too close to call. One, Monica Crowley from Fox News, actually said, "Oh, we think McCain will win by by half a point," right? So
she used to work for Richard Nixon.
Well, it's very hard to justify prediction, right? But the next week, Monica Crowley was invited back, right? She said, "Oh, you know, Obama's win had been inevitable, right, given the circumstances with the economy and Bush's approval rating." And so people either are manipulating the truth or they misremember what they said. But there's not a lot of accountability. People have short memories in television punditry, especially.
What about the people who do take it more seriously? Is part of our prediction problem that statistics and probability aren't taught very well in schools?
I think so. I mean, for me, you know, I work with data in a hands-on way, and things that I think are fun, like baseball and elections, and a lot of the examples in the book should be interesting and fun to people. But that's not how stats are taught in school, right? It tends to be a very formal presentation of it. I think people don't really kind of connect with intuitively. Where if I taught a stats course, I might have kids play poker, not for real money or something like that, right? Or get their hands dirty on real data, just like the way a literature course is taught, where you don't learn syntax, you read books and explore the themes and see what good writing is like in that respect. I don't know why we have this double standard in the way that math is taught, but I think that's part of the problem. People become phobic of numbers and data when really it's just another kind of language for looking at the world, and it ought to be grounded in the real world. It ought to make sense and test ideas and hypotheses. That's what this is for. It's not just for playing with numbers for numbers' sake.
So did you intend this book to be in part a primer on how to use statistics in different settings? Because you use very clear and simple examples throughout the book to make your point.
Yeah, I think with the book we're trying to strike a balance between people who might have been data phobic in the past and saying, look, this stuff ought to make sense. There are some complexities here, but you can apply this to lots of real world problems. But at the same time, we also want to have a book where if you are more experienced, if you are a practitioner, that you can find wisdom in there as well. And the one advantage I have is that I'm combining kind of my skills as a journalist, where I'm going out and talking to people with hands-on experience. So it's neither purely an insider's or an outsider's account. It's trying to hopefully distill the best of both those perspectives.
Well, many statisticians will say something along the lines of, it's the data speaking, when they try to explain how they've come to this conclusion.
Well, and, you know, the problem is that in cases where the data isn't very rich, like, say, a presidential election or something, the data can speak in different ways depending on the interpreter, where, for example, in 2008, there were different models that political scientists made to predict the outcome of the election. And those models had everything from John McCain winning by 7 points to Barack Obama winning by 15. You take the average of those and they do okay. But all these, there are different ways to take information and use it to make predictions. It can reflect your biases potentially. It can reflect subtle flaws in your thinking. So, you know, that doesn't really suffice to say, oh, I'm being objective, I'm being data-driven. I think there is objectivity exists along a spectrum, but the ultimate test is, do your predictions hold up in the end? Predictions are a way to test whether your subjective view matches up with the objective reality.
We've seen that recently in a couple of instances where polls were stronger for the president. That's before the more recent polls where he lost some percentage points. But when they looked really strong, some Republicans said, well, the pollsters have a bias toward the Democratic candidate. More recently, the jobs report,
right.
There is Jack Welch saying, well, the books have been cooked, even though these statistics were put together by people who are, in theory anyway, apolitical.
Yeah, this is such a textbook example of people cherry picking the data and not really making very good arguments for, you know, for why all the polls suddenly have a bias when they haven't in the past. But now, of course, you get a surprisingly good jobs report on Friday, and the same commentators who have been using these numbers for months and months to say this is why Obama should be voted out of office are now distrusting them. If you just they're not being intellectually consistent, right? If you say in general, oh, the jobs data is really noisy, you have to look at a lot of data to tell where the economy is headed, I believe that we should never put that much emphasis on one report. But if you're blatantly just cherry-picking and saying, I'm going to pay attention to this when I like the news and not when I don't, I mean, that's people who are saying that they're giving away that they shouldn't be looked at as being credible. They're not even – objectivity is hard to attain, but these people aren't even trying.
Well, many people have complained about how these statistics are put together. So the answer, you might say, would be to come up with a better statistical analysis rather than say it's accurate when it agrees with your biases and inaccurate when it doesn't.
Yeah. So we have a forecast of the election, which is based in part on economic numbers. But we look at seven different data series, one of them being the jobs report. But we want to have more of a consensus view. That way you're not going to be surprised by one report that is out of line with the broader trend.
And we'll come back to that after we take a little break. My guest is Nate Silver. His book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't, it's published by the Penguin Press. We're back with Nate Silver, a statistician, writer, and founder of the New York Times political blog 538.com. He is also the developer of Picota, a system for forecasting baseball performance that was bought by Baseball Prospectus. Named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. His latest book, your first book.
First book.
Mm-hmm. And your latest, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. It is published by Penguin Press. You write about the financial crisis that began in 2007, which seems
sure.
entirely predictable after the fact. But why wasn't it before?
Well, crises always do seem more predictable in hindsight, and that's why it's important to distinguish someone from who's fit a model to past data from actually making real predictions about the future. But there were basically two chunks of this that conspired to make the crisis as bad as it was. Number one was the fact that people were making a lot of side bets on the mortgage market, where for every dollar in actual mortgage that someone was buying, there were about $50 worth of bets on the side. And number two is that the credit rating agencies told us all these securities were very safe, when in fact they were anything but.
Well, there are thousands of people on Wall Street whose job it is to make predictions about what the market will do. A few were correct, but they were pretty much ignored.
Well, if you're on Wall Street, then if you think about what are my personal incentives, you often want to stay with the herd, stay with the crowd. And usually people on Wall Street who have bearish views aren't looked on so favorably until there's a crisis and they seem like geniuses potentially. But you had people, I think, kind of following the rating agencies' guidance, and often they had this reputation for being very conservative, but they were leading people off a cliff and kind of enabling a lot of the kind of drunkenness almost literally in the mortgage market that occurred prior to the housing collapse.
Well, it's my opinion that if you predict that somewhere down the line, everything is going to go downhill, there's going to be some terrible things happening. You're almost always right.
Sure, and we should remember that when Alan Greenspan used the phrase irrational exuberance to describe the activity in tech stocks, the NASDAQ still went up by another three times or so before it crashed. And so it can be – even if you have a view that's correct, and there were a lot of people certainly in the housing market who did call it, even if you have a view that's correct, it's not so easy to cash in on that. You have to be very patient, and shorting a stock is very risky. So I think you can have – some people say, well – if you're so sure of this, why don't you bet against it? The mechanics of the market don't always make that so easy. So sometimes it takes a while for it to catch up.
A listener called to ask about the black swan phenomenon in which the highly improbable happens. So, that's a problem for anyone who's predicting.
Sure, I mean, people assume that you have these nice bell curve distributions where it becomes very, very improbable you have an error of a certain magnitude. But in everything from the stock market to polling, that doesn't always describe how things really go. In 2008, famously, of course, the polls had Obama winning by 8 points or something in the New Hampshire primary, and there were tens of thousands of people interviewed. So the Siskel error was supposedly very small, right? But Hillary won instead. Everyone was kind of making the same mistake with the polls. They weren't capturing the late movement in the race. And so sometimes you have these catastrophic errors. And what happens is that when people are hurting off one another and you lose that kind of diversity and the way people are making bets on the stock market, or the way that people are conducting polls, then you have the risk of a big mistake where everyone is wrong in the same direction.
And you write that the more interviews a person gave, the worse their ability to predict accurately. So should we not believe a word we hear on cable news?
I know. I fear my predictions will become worse the more media hits that I do. But there have been studies showing people who were purported experts, meaning that they made their living talking about economics or political science, and the people who went on TV more often made worse predictions. You know, I hope that for me, I can tell people that at least I have my reputation on the line with these forecasts, and we have forecasts on the 538 website every day that we update. But in general, people do better when they have money on the line instead of reputation. And that's why we look favorably upon, for example, poker players and sports bettors in the book, to some degree, investors, because they are really putting their money where their mouth is.
Nate Silver's book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't, is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Last week, many thought that President Obama's debate performance hurt his reelection chances. And then came a very positive jobs report, which we mentioned on Friday. People were saying that it would help him win in November. So should we weigh those two things equally?
I'm not sure we should weigh them equally. I tend to think the debates a little bit more important based on what we know so far. But you did see the polls for Romney seem to be very strong in the immediate day or two after the debate. And then some pollsters over the weekend showed the race not reverting back to where it was before the debate, but seemed to be suggestive of Obama still holding a lead. And by the way, I think that's what we should expect, where for many months before the conventions, this was about a 2-point race with Obama a slight favorite. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if we end up in the same place. It seems like how the election should be, quote unquote, based on the national conditions, based on Obama's approval rating and so forth.
As of yesterday afternoon, 538 is saying that President Obama had a 78.4% chance of winning. Mitt Romney had a 21.6% chance of winning. That's pretty overwhelming.
It's pretty decisive, but people should remember when you get late in the election, then you kind of want to analogize it to say a football game, where a team that holds a 1-touchdown lead in the fourth quarter of a football game wins that game 85% of the time. Even though it's a 1-score game, the other team can come back. It's close by any definition. But remember, you're competing against the clock in some sense in politics, and against the number of undecided voters. And so there aren't very many undecideds left. There's not very much time left. So we'll see where the numbers settle in. But if Romney is down, say, only 2 points, then it's a very winnable election for him. But based on history, Obama's percentage odds are still pretty good. He'd probably be a 3-to-1 favorite or so.
Well, how do we go about figuring out how much weight to give each piece of information? Is that where data from past election becomes important?
It can, and you can take a simple approach. Like if, for example, you look at who was leading in the Gallup poll on October 1st of each year, and how often did that candidate go on to win? And it turns out that in 18 of the last 20 elections, the candidate leading in the Gallup poll on October 1st did win. The exceptions were Dewey in 1948 was defeated by Truman, and in 2000, Al Gore had a lead in the popular vote at this time. He did win the popular vote, but lost the Electoral College.
You write about the work of psychology and political science professor Philip Tetlock, who divided people into foxes and hedgehogs, taking Isaiah Berlin's lead. Why are foxes better at predicting than hedgehogs?
Well, see, so hedgehogs are people that have these big and bold theories about the world, and they tend to be more ideological. They think that Everything can be explained by some ideological view, whereas hedgehogs are more, excuse me, foxes are more multifaceted, where they say, look, I'm going to be more empirical. I'm going to gather people's different points of view together, be more multidisciplinary, you know, hedge my bets a little bit more, think more probabilistically. And those little things tend to add up. They tend to be a little bit more humble about how good they are at prediction, but there's much less of a gap between how good they think they are and how good they really are.
And we've been hearing a lot about how the narrative plays a major role
right.
in how an election will turn out and who determines how that narrative plays out.
So we encourage people at 538 to be a little suspicious about the media narrative in the campaign. Remember, the news media is trying to sell papers, trying to get people to kind of click and watch. And it's much easier to do that when you say, Obama's lead is collapsing, it's all tied up, or before, Romney's campaign is imploding, is it already over, right? Those kind of exaggerated headlines and lead stories sound really good on cable TV, but they usually ignore the more complicated pieces of evidence. And so that's why by looking at the consensus of the data, the polls and economic numbers and so forth, it might give you a more complicated story, but also a truer one. I think we have sometimes we have to resist this bias to oversimplify everything. It would be great if we could just take a snapshot of things and say, okay, that's all I need, right? But the devil is in the detail a lot of the time.
And we like those narratives. Al Gore is a policy wonk. He claimed that he invented the internet.
Right.
Whether those things are true or not, they become the way we view a candidate, whoever the candidate is.
Well, it was interesting. On the debate last week, I happened to get home about 15 minutes late, so I didn't see the first 15 minutes. But based on my Twitter feed, it seemed like it had already been decided that Obama had lost. I don't think he did a good job by any means, but it did seem like now with the way kind of come to collective decisions, right? And this is one of the things people assume that, you have more information, people can be more independent-minded. And we see maybe the opposite now, I think, where we're so networked and connected that we kind of lose that diversity of perspectives that we once did.
Why did you launch 538? Were you frustrated by how polls were portrayed in the media?
So part of it is I had, before launching 538, I had worked in baseball for several years, and I had seen just in the five or so years I've been doing that, a kind of paradigm shift in how data and statistics were looked at, where the Moneyball narrative that Michael Lewis told really was true when I first came into the game in 2003, where you had kind of the jocks and the nerds on opposite sides of the aisle, and there was a lot of tension. But that all changed very fast, where you had teams like the A's and the Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays using statistics to get an edge in their competition, and they were doing very well. And the one thing about baseball is that there is a bottom line. Do you win or lose? That's a pretty crisp and clear indicator. So it tends to incentivize improving yourself and moving toward better and better methods.
Although this year the A's have done very well and the Red Sox have done incredibly poorly.
So
what does that mean?
Well, there are no guarantees. But the point is still that in baseball you saw this occurring, whereas in political coverage it still seemed to be back in the Stone Ages. The campaigns themselves, it's kind of a reverse Moneyball, where you do see the inside game. The campaigns are very knowledgeable about how to target voters, for example. But the average news coverage is so narrative driven, and that stuff, look, it can be entertaining and fun, but sometimes it's much too self-serious.
One of the prospects that your assistant Pakoda picked out was second baseman Dustin Pedroia, who scouts had discounted for a number of reasons, including his height. What was your analysis picking up that the scouts weren't?
So it was a subtle factor in Pedroia's case, but so he was kind of short and stocky, and for most players it doesn't work all that well. But for second baseman, it works quite well because you can be low to the ground, so you can be more agile. Also, the way he acts as a hitter is he has a small strike zone and he has a good batting eye, and so being small means the pitcher has less of a target to throw to. So he took his apparent weaknesses and really used them more as strengths. And what the model, Pakoda realized, is that if you look at other great second basemen, Joe Morgan, maybe the best second baseman of all time, was also only, I think, 5'8 or so. Most of the second basemen in the Hall of Fame were under 6 feet tall. And so that's a case where in baseball you have so much data that you can afford to pick very detailed comparisons. Say we have hundreds of thousands of players we can look at, so let's pick the ones that really are most similar to Dustin Pedroia and tell a story based on that. That's the luxury you have when you have such excellent data like you have in sports.
And height we see in other sports as well. Quarterbacks for a while were any quarterback under 6'4". Was discounted because the conventional wisdom was you had to see over the linemen. But we've had some pretty great quarterbacks in the history of football who were under 6 feet tall.
Yeah, so anytime there's one case that disproves everything else. So, for example, Jeremy Lin, and somehow for some reason let go by the Knicks, right? But he was completely overlooked. And now I'd be pretty sure that the next time you have a good point guard prospect from the Ivy League, he'll get a lot more credit. Maybe he'll be overdrafted even, right? But he did not fit the stereotype of what an NBA prospect is supposed to look at. So our blind spots kind of ignored him. It was the same case as for Pedroia in many ways.
In your conclusion, you're right. Prediction is difficult for us. The same reason that is so important, it is where objective and subjective reality intersect. So does that mean that we need to see prediction as both an art and a science?
Well, I think prediction ought to be thought of as more of a science, but it's one where you have to make decisions. It's pure as we might like it to be a lot of the time. And the thing that makes it difficult is that you simultaneously have to hold in your head two things. Number one, you have to believe in objective truth, that we are pushing towards something. But number two, that we're never going to attain it fully, where as smart as our computers might be and as smart as we might think we are, we're still very small as compared to this whole universe of data and information. And so we can get to better and better approximations of the truth, but never get there completely. It almost requires, I think, a kind of Zen-like way of thinking. And one of the poker players I talked to in the book actually coaches his students in Zen meditation, because it's frustrating to know that you can play a poker hand as well as you possibly can and still lose a lot of time because your opponent catches a lucky card. You have to have that levity, I think, to really make progress.
Is it easier to predict an election when there are two candidates than something like the World Series? Last year, would it have been possible for you to pick the Cardinals, who were a wild card team?
So in baseball, which is a game where the teams are usually very close, the good teams and talent, you would never want to say right now, when there are still eight teams left in the playoffs, that, oh, this team is an outright favorite to win the World Series. You just can't have as much of an edge. In basketball, you could. You could probably say, look, right now there might be a 70% chance that either the Heat or the Lakers will win the NBA title. And, you know, if they don't, it'll probably be the Oklahoma City Thunder. There may be only three or four teams that are really a factor. But anyone who's watched baseball knows that the best team doesn't always win in a short series.
The Mets lose all the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, if you're making predictions involving the Cubs, for example, or the Mets, there does seem to be some kind of some long-term stellar problems that prevent them from doing very well. But for any other team that obeys by the ordinary laws of probability and statistics, you have to always be pretty careful with your baseball picks.
Nate Silver's book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be watching your blog at the New York Times.
Terrific. Thank you for having me.